Joe Norman, Reel 2.
You go to the Lenin School first. And it'll be more used to us, you know, that's the way I put it.
What did you learn there?
Political economy, you know. Yeah, how to debate, how to drop, how to make, how to plan a speech, you know. All useful stuff, agitation or education. And after 6 months there, I came back and I did a number of political meetings up and down Lancashire. You know, I became a daily worker organiser in Wigan, you know. But I wasn't happy. I wanted to go to Spain. I was a trained sailor. Armaments and so on, and I wanted to use my skills there. So eventually, we had a man called George Brown, a leader of the Lancashire Party. He went to Spain, and he was killed at Carama. And he represented the Lancashire district in Spain, you see. That's how they did things. So I said, well, it looks as though we've got to send someone else from the Lancashire district, you know, not just anybody, but a leader of the Lancashire district. So I said, right. He chose me to go. A bit of prompting.
You mean you prompted them?
I prompted them, yeah.
How much news had you been receiving about what was going on in Spain?
Oh, constantly. The Morning Star and the Daily News, you know, that a liberal paper. But most of the news, of course, outside of the Morning Star and the Daily Worker then, and the that liberal paper, it was confusing, you know. It was all, they made it up. They covered it up with this religious issue, you know, and atrocities on the Republican side and so on, you know. Of course, they didn't mention much about the atrocities on the fascist side, you know. But then...
What made you want to go?
Well, I was a keen anti-fascist, you know, very keen. I wasn't political more than really anti-fascist, not political, you know, you know, a trade union point of view mostly, you know, militant trade unionist. Although I was in the party, I was mainly a militant trade unionist, you know, with an anti-fascist, a keen anti-fascist outlook, you know, and do anything to combat fascism, both in Britain and anywhere else. I would do today. And then when I got the go-ahead, I went to London and we went on a weekend ticket to France. Of course, you didn't need a passport in those days. And we dodged around Paris. It was a Paris exhibition then, July. And we dodged around Paris. Of course, they had to watch the organisers of the Volunteers for Spain going through France. Had to watch the police, because the police were opposed, you know, the government was opposed to us fighting in Spain. And we had to dodge around till we got across to the Pyrenees, you know.
How did you know where to go and what to do?
Well, we were met by the leaders of the anti-fascist movement in France. Communists, anti-fascists, all sorts. There were all sorts. There was not only just the Communist Party that was leading it, but mostly the Communist Party were leading the influx of volunteers. In the early days, it was mostly the Communist Party that supplied the troops and the leadership. But later on, of course, the broad labour movement and trade union movement came in, you see, after the change of opinions in the Labour Party and the trade union movement.
Did you go in a party from London?
Yes. I led 9 people across France, across the Pyrenees. And funnily enough, A couple of months ago in Luton, although I'm now a member of the Labour Party, a leading member, funnily enough, in Luton, I got an invitation to go to a rally there at the Communist at the East Midlands Communist Party in college there at Luton. They wanted to present me with a sort of fancy address for my services for democracy, you know. And I went there, and there were six international brigaders there. Of course, it didn't only include international brigaders, and they weren't all members of the Communist Party, you know, there were all kinds of people. People who'd been in the party or the movement 54 years and stuff like that, you know. And, a boy came to me, he said, "Hello, John." You know. And I said, "Oh, you've got the advantage of me." He said, "What?" He said, "You led me over the Pyrenees." His name was Starrett. He was an engineer, you know. Come in, Starrett. I couldn't recall his face, but he could recall mine. He said, "You led us over the Pyrenees."
Did you speak French?
No, I didn't speak anything. I don't think I spoke English properly.
Well, that seems quite a venture for someone speaking no French and with a weekend ticket to set out leading nine people across the Pyrenees.
Yes, but I wasn't on my own. You know, there was people meeting us, you see. The word was sent on, we'd be at a certain place at a certain time, you know. And they were there. Well, they weren't there, there was trouble, you know. They probably got wept, picked up by the police, you see. But they were there. Really cast iron, the organisation, you know. And they took us to places, and they fed us, you know, and took us around Paris until it was time to move. And then they bundled us into a bus, you know, off, dead of night, you know. We did that all the time. And then we got to the Pyrenees.
Did you have any trouble with the French police at any
point? Oh, yes. We never clashed, because we always knew, because we even had comrades in the police. If there was anything happening, to give us the wire, don't go there, don't meet tonight, you know, they're waiting for you. So eventually we climbed the Pyrenees, we met the guide, you know. When I say I led, I mean I had my party which I was responsible for, you see. And we went over the Pyrenees, it took us 6 hours, you know, to pitch dark. And just as the sun rose, we landed in Figueres, you know, the other side of the Pyrenees. From Figueres, I went to the training base.
Had you gone out to Spain with any clothing, any equipment?
None. At the training base, they gave us all a suit of clothes, you know, Glengarry and khaki tunic, trousers. Yeah, that's about all you got. We usually kept the boots we had on, you know. Of course, occasionally, you know, we got a new supply. If you've been in action and you're filthy, you know, we're able to clean a uniform or give you a new one, you know. We didn't do too badly for clothing and food, you know. A lot of times in action it got rough, you know, and you couldn't get food up.
Were you married then, when you went?
No, I wasn't married then. I was married within, and I came back in 1938.
What did your family think of your going?
Oh, there were no opposition. None at all. In fact, they were rather proud, you know.
How How did your training in Spain compare with the training you had in Britain in the RNVR?
Well, the training was first class, but we had no proper rifles, very few rifles, and the few rifles we had were very old things, you know. Old Lee Enfields from the First World War and that sort of thing. Mind you, it was a good rifle, but there wasn't enough of them, you know. Till eventually the Russians managed to get, after losing 45 ships in the Mediterranean, they managed to get some new Russian rifles. They didn't compare with the Enfields, you know, for quality, but they were pretty good, you know. And then got a few anti-tank guns, you know. But in the main, we got some tanks at one time, but there weren't enough of them, you know. And we took part in various actions. When I got to the battalion, there was an election, and I was elected battalion party organiser, you know, to explain, you know, our objectives in the Spanish struggle.
Is that different from being battalion political commissar?
Oh, yes. the party organiser was there to get the dues, you see, contributions from the lads to pay the party dues, you see, which was handed over to the Red Cross. You see, but it kept us together party-wise, you see. Because, there's no doubt about it, a political understanding, whatever happened, we're able to explain why we were doing this, you know. Now, the political commissar was a different kettle of fish. He was really a personnel officer, you know. He had to understand the politics. But anything went wrong in an action, he held an inquest with the top brass. Why did this go wrong, you see? And then he'd tell us what he found out. Of course, the Spanish army was like any other army, you know. The International Brigade became part of the Spanish army, so we were sort of subservient to them. Whatever they decided, we had to do, you see. Whatever action they decided, we had to go in. And believe me, they pushed us in some awful places, you know. And there were a sort of, the political commissar was, it was for the whole of the men, no matter what party they were in, you see. He looked after their needs, hospital needs, medical needs, clothing needs, food needs, you know. Whatever it was concerning the whole of the British battalion and the Spaniards who were in the British battalion, there was always a battalion of Spaniards, you know, as well as British, you know. But in the early days, of course, they were separate because they weren't organising the International Brigade. There were Yugoslavs, Dimitrov battalions and so on, you see. Bulgarians, Yugoslavs and people like that, Italians. Then after the Republican government decided to synchronise the leadership and incorporate everybody in the country into the Spanish Republican Army, then we came under the command of the Spanish hierarchy, and it was a mixed up crowd, I'll tell you. Some were good and some weren't so good, you know. Some were in the pay of Franco all the time, you know. And
was there a difference for you as an ordinary soldier being in the Spanish army officially?
No difference at all, except there was no, they didn't decide things at the battalion level from a point of view of strategic action, you know. It was decided at brigade level, and from a brigade got it from the division, you know. Division got it from the commanders on the fronts, you know. It only meant, of course, that sometimes we were set into action and we didn't really know why, and it worked. Impossible positions, you know. Of course, we know now from Arthur Landis's book, you know, that there were fascists in high command, and they were giving us a bum steer, so to speak, leading us wrong, just telling us what to do to make sure we got hammered, you know. And many a time we did.
Was the International Brigade put into worse positions sometimes than Spanish?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt about it. In 37, beginning of 38, until they weeded these people, until they found out these people, we got some awful hammers, you know. My company at Cheddarwell lost 13 men in one action. You know. And we were sent into rear guard actions, you know, without any proper information. In fact, after Cheddarwell, we went into the Aragon, and it was a big breakthrough by the fascists. And we didn't know the Listers, which was the crack division, pulled out of this position was untenable. They were facing 80,000 Italians on a breakthrough with artillery and tanks, and they couldn't hold, and they pulled out. We were left in the olive groves, coming in at the night. We lay in the olive groves, waiting for dawn, and there's the Listers pulling out. We knew nothing about. That's when I got captured. The next morning, walked in. We'd lost our battalion observer. Nobody knew where he got to, so Sam Wells said to me, and Tapsell, Joe, take three men and go out in front and observe what you can. We thought we were going into a position to relieve someone. And then all hell broke loose, you know. We just turned the corner and bump. Oh, we swarmed over, you know. We just captured two fascist patrols and handed them back. You know, I thought, well, I'll find something out. And then I looked round and here I'm looking down the tank. Back of fusing you. You know. And then, oh. Tanks formed, past artillery, aircraft. It must have been about the woods on either side, you know. Olive Road was swarming with machine guns, you know, like machine guns and rifles going up. And there was 100 of us snaffled, you know. It was a terrific slaughter.
Why didn't Sam Wild realise what position you were in?
He didn't know, you know.
Is this a failure of communication
between
him and the higher?
Obviously, yeah, yeah. And then we had 8 months in various concentration camps. You know, Gary McCartney was one, remember, the Scottish secretary. And it was a rough experience.
Before you talk about your prison experiences, back while you were fighting in the International Brigade, how was the discipline in the brigade?
Well, after Karama, the discipline began to slip a bit, you know. And that was one of the reasons why the party sent the cream of its leadership, as they thought, to try and lift the morale of the troops. Because at Karama they got such a hammering, you know, and everything was at sixpence. And they'd no leave, you see. The discipline of the troop began to slip a bit. The morale, like any army, if they get a battering and they don't get any relief, you know. So they had to have a fresh influx, you know, to sort of build up the battalion because it was practically decimated.
So what are the symptoms of this lack of discipline after Haroma?
Well, the symptoms were a disinterest, no enthusiasm, you know, to fight. He never refused an order, but didn't fight with enthusiasm like they did in the early days, you know. And sort of apathy, you know.
Were there a number of desertions at this time?
Oh, yes, yeah, there were a number of desertions. Some got away and some didn't. Some were snuffled and put in prison for a time, you know. But it's like any other army, you know. If you deserted and you got caught, you were punished.
Did joining, officially joining the Spanish army affect the discipline?
Yes. Officially joining the Spanish army affected discipline in this sense. But the first time, we had to salute officers. Before an officer saluted an officer, you said, "I do," you know. Well, I think that helped a bit to lift morale as well, you see. Plus the constant explanations, you know, behind the lines, why this was and so on. You know.
There were quite a number of anarchists fighting in Spain, and I should think that would have made problems in relationships between the officers and men.
Well, it's something I never met because I didn't have much to do with officers. Although I was a battalion party organiser and I could go to battalion headquarters and discuss things with the battalion commissar or battalion command, you see. And occasionally I went to brigade, you know, a battalion representative. We didn't see much of this apparent difference between anarchists, communists, labour, what have you, you know. The main idea, they were there to fight fascism, and how we fought it didn't matter greatly as long as we got enough ammunition, enough to eat and we were led properly, you know.
Speaking of being led properly, in the British Army at this time, of course, the people who made up the officer corps tended to come from a public school background and so on. What kind of people did you have for international brigade officers?
I would say 50-50. Working class background, trade union background, middle class, Oxford, Cambridge, what have you.
Were they equally effective?
First class, of course. The first class maybe because they had a political outlook, you see. Mind you, we had a fellow called Nathan. What his politics were I'll never know, but he was marvellous. And what his background was I never knew much about. But I think he was a fully trained army man, you know, with an army background, but a first class leader, you know.
Did you ever meet him personally?
No, I only heard about it from the lads, you know. They're all taken with it.
I suppose most of the people who went out to Spain had political thinking behind their decision, as you did, but in any war, and I think perhaps particularly in that one, there are a lot of people who go along who you could call adventurers.
Oh, they probably were. In fact, it was, you know.
Did they cause any problems between them and the people who were there for political reasons?
Well, this is where the morale comes in. If you got a number of these people in a group after a battle, you know, sour grapes, you know, they hadn't worked out what they thought. You know, it wasn't all the girls and the loot and stuff that they probably thought they might get, you know. Well, it wouldn't help they were grumbling all the time, you know. So that's why we were there, you know. The commissars did their job and the party organiser did his job. Well, if you'd got half a battalion who were party, you know, they'd stiffen there. It stiffened the morale of the troops, and it sort of talked down the adventurous type.
Did the fact that there was this strong party or political base mean that there was less than you would expect in a war of wine, women, looting, and so on? Were you forbidden, for instance?
Oh, no, no. Not forbidden to do anything. But if you were lucky and got a day's leave in Madrid or whatever, Barcelona, well, you were on your own, you see. If you got girls, you got girls, you know. There wasn't a lot, you know. I kept my ears up. And what I never went and leave in Barcelona, in fact, I never got a leave. Only once, I got 3 days sick leave in the hospital.
Not much opportunity there.
There was not, because everything was tightened up. I mean, they were scared of fascists and infiltrators and spies, you know. And both sides had the spies and infiltrators and so on, you know. So there was tightening up, as it was in Britain in wartime, you know. And that sort of thing.
Did you ever see any of the women who were fighting?
No, I never met a woman fighting. Felicia Brown was killed before they formed the International Brigades, you know. It was part of a British battalion that were gone there or were there before the struggle broke out, Spartakiada, you know, or were travelling through at the time. But I never met any of these women fighters. They were there, of course. We saw photographs in the news. A Volunteer for Liberty was published every month, you know. She showed you pictures of other fronts, other leaders and other people, you know, and what they thought and so on. It's usual morale boosting stuff, you know, if you get in any army.
How good an idea did you have at the time of how the war was progressing outside your own immediate battles?
Quite frankly, apart from propaganda, which tends to paint an optimistic picture. And at that time, the optimistic picture was true. We had successes. We had losses. We had setbacks, you know. But apart from our own front, we could see our own successes. We could see our own defeats, you know. But you were taking a lot off for granted when you accepted all the propaganda. Because we did, most of us did accept the propaganda, you know, because we know better now. It wasn't so in some places. They were telling downright lies about what was happening on the fronts, you know. There again, probably to boost morale, you know.
You've mentioned the visit of various Labour leaders from Britain.
Yes. Noel Baker, Professor Noel Baker, he was secretary to Clem Attlee, the Labour leader, and Ellen Wilkinson came to the battalion. And I was in number one company, and we named in honour of the Labour leader, because his visit was a big thing, a big stimulus to recruitment and to the morale of the troops, to feel that the Labour movement in Britain was behind us. And we named the Major Attlee Company, the number one company, the Major Attlee Company, you know, and I was present at that presentation of the flag. The British Trade Union Movement collected a flag, you know, the pole with a fist on the end, silver pole, you know, public in Spain, you know, so on. International Brigade. It's got now in the London Museum, Clerkenwell Green.
What did they tell you?
They told us that they realized that that they were mistaken in supporting non-intervention, which was a big thing, and that they were prepared to fight and rouse the labour and trade union movement in support of the International Brigade and in support of the Spanish Republican government. No more than that. And then they, you know, they shone around, they chatted amongst us, and then they went to a dinner, you know, which I didn't attend because I wasn't big enough, you know. Just one of the lads, you know.